Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and the decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to SCOTUS Cast. I'm your host, Kyle Hammerness, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. Today we have a moderated discussion on Murthy versus Missouri, in which the Supreme Court issued a 6-3 decision on June 26, 2024. It is my honor to introduce our moderator today, Brent Scora. Brent is a legal fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies. And with that, I'd like to turn things over to Brent to introduce our guests.
I want to thank Federalist Society for hosting this conversation. The Murthy case is as Justice Alito said in dissent, one of the biggest free speech cases the Supreme Court has taken up in a while. It's great to see a lot of interest in it. So I'll introduce the panelists and then we'll go to discussion in alphabetical order. Court Barthold is Tech Freedom's Internet Policy Counsel and Director of Appellate Litigation. He received his JD from UC Berkeley School of Law. He clerked for the Honorable Stephen D. Merriday at the Middle District of Florida and the Honorable Robert H. Cleland in the Eastern District of Michigan. After his clerkships, Corbin was an associate and later partner at the Los Angeles office of Brown George Ross LLP, and he has since joined the public interest law world. And we're glad he has. Josh Devine is Solicitor General of Missouri, where he oversees the office's appellate and special litigation divisions. He received his JD from Yale Law School, and he clerked for Supreme Court, first 11th Circuit Judge William Pryor, and then at the Supreme Court for Justice Thomas. Before serving as Solicitor General, he was Chief Counsel to U.S. Senator Josh Hawley. And finally, Janine Yunus is litigation counsel for the New Civil Liberties Alliance. She holds a JD from NYU School of Law. She spent the first part of her career as an appellate public defender in New York City, including arguing several cases before the New York State Court of Appeals. So I'd like to go first to Janine and provide the audience, the viewers, listeners who perhaps weren't aware of the Murthy case before last week, but you know, follow the Supreme Court and have an interest in free speech issues. You and NCLA represented a few clients in this case. So take a few minutes, please cover the facts in this case, your clients, as well as the district court and Fifth Circuit decisions in the case.
Thank you so much for having me. I might need more than a few minutes. I'll be as concise as possible. So we represented four individual plaintiffs. Probably the two most people know are Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff, who were co-authors of the Great Barrington Declaration, which was a declaration that eschewed lockdowns, basically saying that they were more harmful to society than they were helpful. And they're epidemiologists at Harvard and Stanford. We also represented Aaron Cariotti, a psychiatrist who declined to get the COVID vaccine because he had natural immunity and lost his professorship as a result, and Jill Hines, a health freedom worker in Louisiana. And their core allegation was that they were censored on social media, but not essentially because of the platform's content moderation policies, but because the government had inserted itself into COVID-related censorship. Now, I also want to clarify, there's another plaintiff in the case, Jim Hoft, who we didn't represent, who was alleging government interference with his speech that was more about the 2020 election and the Hunter Biden laptop, since the government was also involved in trying to get those topics suppressed on social media. The facts in this case, it was a 20,000 page record, even though this was just up on appeal from a preliminary injunction. So it's hard to summarize them briefly, but essentially the White House, various agencies such as the CDC, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is housed within DHS, the FBI had in various ways tried to influence the companies in order to censor disfavored speech. When it came to the White House, there was often a lot of coercion going on. There were direct threats, private and public, to try to repeal Section 230's protections, which, as most people know, the companies rely on in order to not have to be held liable for what people say on their platforms, which the platforms need in order to function as social media, where people can just post whenever they want. Also, there were threats to look at antitrust provisions, and the platforms had reason to fear that the administration was actually going to do this. Some of the conduct was more collaborative. For instance, when it came to the CDC, Facebook and other social media companies were kind of working in tandem with the government, saying, like, we're going to take these kind of posts down. The CDC would send examples of posts that should be taken down, flagging, you know, so-called vaccine misinformation, mask misinformation, that kind of thing. I think it's really important to point out that although the First Amendment protects, you know, so-called misinformation, even false speech, our plaintiffs were not saying things that were false. They were saying mostly true things. I would say perhaps almost entirely true things. And Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff are two of the top epidemiologists in the world, and they were being censored at the behest of the Biden administration on topics, on the areas of their expertise. So I think this case really highlights why we have a First Amendment and why we don't allow the government to be involved in this kind of thing, or in suppressing viewpoints that it disagrees with. So the core allegations, some additional allegations were raised in the complaint, but the core, especially on the preliminary injunction, the core complaint was First Amendment violations. And the idea was that the government was sort of instrumentalizing these private companies to accomplish its censorship aims. And that was effectively a First Amendment violation because the government can't use private industry to accomplish what it can't directly. So the district court in the Western District of Louisiana found for us almost entirely, found that the plaintiffs had standing, and found that this was on a preliminary injunction, but that the government had likely violated their First Amendment rights and that the harm was irreparable. So granted the preliminary injunction. It was mostly upheld by the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit kicked out a couple of the defendants. So they found there wasn't enough evidence that NIAID, NIH, so mostly we're talking about Dr. Fauci, that he was actually involved in this censorship. So he was not in the injunction. Importantly, also the district court denied the government's motion to dismiss the complaint. So the case in the district court is still live, despite the fact that the Supreme Court reversed the grant of the preliminary injunction.
Yeah, thank you for that. Apologies. A little housekeeping. It's great. We have two people representing parties in this case, which is great. And I want to thank Solicitor General Devine for taking time out of a busy schedule, I'm sure, for coming. Next, I'd like to turn to Corbin and ask for an assessment of the district court and Fifth Circuit opinions. I know I listened to podcasts from you and why I reached out to you. You had some good reservations about the nature of the injunction, the breadth of the injunction. I think you may have had issues with the standing as well. So, and obviously the Supreme Court, found the standing issues to be most salient here. So Corbin, for you, your assessment of the district court, Fifth Circuit opinion, and also the Supreme Court opinion, just how they came down, how they did.
Sure. Okay. So as with the first question, there's a lot there. It was pretty clear to me how things were probably going to go with the rest of the case from July 4th, 2023. That's the day the district court issued its opinion. The district court took what it called a bird's eye view of traceability And so it kind of glossed over the actual record, didn't really make an attempt to link any government conduct with any specific act of content moderation. More importantly, though, the court presented a factual analysis that was so riddled with errors and fabrications that it was clearly going to be useless to any reviewing court. Also, the judge bought into the, you know, the censorship industrial complex narrative, in which the Stanford Internet Observatory was supposedly a puppet of the government through CISA, instead of a group doing its own independent research and advocacy, and let's not forget exercising its own First Amendment rights. So those problems trickled up to the Supreme Court. The government had to say in a footnote in its reply that it couldn't possibly respond to all the inaccuracies that were floating around, which was true. Justice Sotomayor said at oral argument that she couldn't untangle all the inaccuracies in the plaintiff's brief. She said, quote, "You know, I have such a problem with your brief, counselor. You omit information that changes the context of some of your claims. You attribute things to people who it didn't happen to, I don't know what to make of all this." And at the oral argument, the SG of Louisiana, you know, I'm afraid he didn't really help matters. He kind of bounced around. The justices struggled to understand him. Justice Barrett said she wasn't even sure what his argument was. He said, you know, "I'm a First Amendment purist," and then he wasn't able to present the scope of the categories of unprotected speech correctly when talking with Justice Kagan. So the opinion didn't end up really being a surprise. At footnote 4, the justices, the majority, wrote, "The Fifth Circuit relied on the district court's factual findings, many of which unfortunately appear to be clearly erroneous." And again, I mean, that's true. Throughout our discussion, it's important to remember that the district court sort of thoroughly botched the factual record here. The majority noted that neither the district court nor the Court of Appeals made any specific causation findings with respect to any discrete instances of content moderation. It noted that Justice Alito, in dissent, basically had to construct a theory of causation on his own. And the majority, for its part, basically just refused to do that. It trotted out the old line about how judges aren't pigs hunting for truffles in the record. So in the end, Justice Alito could formulate his dissent kind of only by boiling things down extensively. He bypassed almost all of the sort of gish gallop of facts and allegations that had been thrown around below. And so the censorship industrial complex stuff fell by the wayside. We didn't hear anything about sort of like significant encouragement or entanglement. He had to kind of construct for himself a Bantam Books analysis that was nothing like what the plaintiffs had presented at oral argument, where they'd argue that sort of any request by the government to take something down crosses the line. So while job owning is a really concerning issue, and I hope we can all kind of agree on that through the discussion, my take was this just wasn't really a good case to decide much of anything. Now, moving to the Supreme Court decisions, you know, once the case got narrowed down to how the majority and the dissent framed things, I do think there's reasonable disagreement over the proper outcome. You had sort of this jousting with different Supreme Court standing decisions, and maybe we can get into that more. You know, Justice Alito certainly had a point that the court should try to apply its standing doctrine consistently. But what you basically had was agreement, like at least at a high level, that the government exerted pressure on the platforms to moderate content related to COVID-19 in the 2020 election. But the majority said that it had to work, quote, "to untangle the mass of the plaintiff's injuries and government communications." And once it did that, it just couldn't find any solid links. So, you know, to give one example, we heard about the Great Barrington Declaration, but the majority found that the platforms had taken action against that before there was really any communication between the platforms and the government. So I think the ultimate take home is the majority wasn't willing to engage in sort of this imaginative reconstruction of the vast record that was plopped in a pile before it. That was kind of my biggest take home.
All right, thank you for that. Next, I'd like to turn to Solicitor General Devine. And if you could talk about, I guess, first of all, talk about Missouri's interest in the case for a bit. A little unusual to see a state. I was glad to see Missouri take an interest in the case, but talk about the state's interest and also, yeah, I filed this case and there was, if you could also talk about some of the depositions and evidence, that turned up in this case, and then I'll probably follow up as well.
Yeah, so I'll take those in order. So Missouri's interest in this case, one of the theories of standing that we pressed is that, you know, there's this long line of cases from by the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court doesn't really discuss very much in this opinion, which is that the states have an interest in hearing from their citizens. You've got a bunch of different cases, Terminiello, Garnieri, that all discuss that the part of the purpose of the First Amendment and part of the purpose of free speech is to enable states to really hear from their citizens so that they can be responsive to the needs and concerns of their citizens. So that's one of the theories of standing we advance here. And that's a definite state interest. The Supreme Court didn't deny that. Instead, what it said is that, you know, that, well, you need to be a little bit more specific in the type of thing that you're wanting to hear. The problem, of course, is, you know, when things are being censored, nobody really knows what this universe is. You know, that's the whole point. It's being censored. And so you don't know exactly what's going on. You don't exactly know what you're unable to hear at that point. And so the Supreme Court's kind of set up this impossible standard from the perspective of the listener's ability to identify the things that they would like to hear, but they're unable to. The second thing that the Supreme Court does is it pretty much ignores about 20 years of precedence with respect to the ability of states to bring what are called parens patriae lawsuits against the federal government. So you've got these cases from the 90s and early 2000s where the Supreme Court allows states to do that. And basically a parens patriae action just means you're in essence you're asserting that there's a very widespread harm to the people of Missouri, to the people of the state. And what you're essentially doing is you're asserting that this harm has become so widespread that it has in fact become an injury to the state itself. And the Supreme Court allowed this in a 1995 case. The Supreme Court allowed this in a 2007 case. And what they did here is they dug up dicta from a 1960s case. And they said, and they just cite that and say, well, this is, you know, the states can't bring parens patriae suits against the federal government. But if you actually look at that, that's dealing with situations where the state isn't actually asserting its own kind of harm. It's purely asserting the third party harms of other individuals. In every single case where a state has asserted its own theory of harm, the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed the state to bring a parens patriae action. And the Supreme Court just completely misses that entire line of doctrine, doesn't discuss it at all. And so I think we've got a very unusual parens patriae decision from the Supreme Court on this issue that really just doesn't wrestle with that fundamental difference and what gives the states the ability and the interest to bring a suit like this. I want to respond to a couple of things that Corbin said. I think we've got a large amount of no surprise that one of the individuals representing these individuals these plaintiffs disagrees with what Corbin said. Let me just leave it at this, which is that nobody really disputes at the Supreme Court. Nobody really disputes that there were very severe First Amendment violations that were going on. I mean, the majority opinion, for example, discusses at one point, like, yeah, it looks like that pressure from the federal government actually altered the policies of Facebook and Twitter and these other organizations. But then the Supreme Court says, but, you know, and that's a past violation. You can't necessarily get prospective relief from that. But they don't deny that there were blatant violations. The government had insinuated itself into this atmosphere and had actually physically changed the policies of Facebook and other organizations to induce further future suppression. But I think just from a causation standpoint, if you look at the facts, if you look at what happened in July 2021, you see a rapid, much more aggressive posture from the White House, from the Surgeon General, from some of the other defendants in July 2021. Much more aggressive. And then you find an uptick in censorship after that. So it's never been our position that that there hasn't been some censorship or suppression or content moderation or whatever term you want to use. It's never been our position that there hasn't been some of that already going on by the platforms. But what we identified are, you've got some of these discrete events, July 2021, huge increase in aggression from the White House. And then you also see an increase in content moderation or suppression or censorship. And it doesn't take a genius to be able to draw that inference there. Now, look, you can't draw a certainty inference there, but the doctrine doesn't require any kind of certainty. It requires a likelihood. And so, I do want to very strongly dispute the idea that we didn't establish causation, that we didn't do anything like that. I think the Supreme Court basically looked at the record and, refused to draw a single inference in our favor, which was different from the district court and different from the Court of Appeals.
I'll ask a follow-up on that, just something that jumped out in the opinion. Then I'll ask each of you for things that jumped out in the opinion and in oral arguments itself. But just following Solicitor General Devine's comment. So the majority's about traceability. The majority statement said, the primary weakness in this record, and this is a quote, in the record of past restrictions is the lack of specific causation findings with respect to any discrete instance of content moderation, end quote. So maybe Janine, first to go to you. I'm not an expert on standing, frankly. That seems like a very high standard to establish standing, that you need to show in the First Amendment context specific causation findings with respect to any discrete instance of content moderation. Your response to that statement from the court?
Yeah, it seems to me that the court's basically requiring that you show that a specific post was censored because of the government, which seems very, very hard to do. And so this was actually an example that came out later through a congressional investigation, but it's a very clear one. There were internal emails from Meta that were revealed as a result of this investigation, where Nick Clegg, who's an executive there, wrote to another employee and said, can you remind me why we censored the lab leak theory? And the other employee says, because we were under pressure from the White House, we shouldn't have done it. Unfortunately, that was not part of the record because it was came out after the Fifth Circuit briefing. And there's a lot of stuff in the record that is very similar to that. That's just the most stark example. So I think it crystallizes it. But that is very clear that this entire theory, this entire narrative, this entire line of thought was censored on social media because of the government. And I think even there, the court is insinuating that you would have to show that your specific post was censored because the government had called you out or named you. I don't know who's going to be able to do that. There may be two people. I can think of RFK and Alex Berenson, who are specifically singled out by government officials by name. I also want to respond to, if I may, one thing that Corbin said about the factual inaccuracies. I really want to dispute that. This was a 20,000 page record. The court, the district court might have gotten it, it said a couple of things not exactly the way I would have characterized them. There was one email from Rob Flaherty where Flaherty was using very colorful language to demand the takedown of a parody account of the president's granddaughter. And it wasn't about COVID misinformation, but we had actually not misrepresented that. And I think that was what was insinuated. We were showing it as part of a pattern of the government's treating these companies as sort of subservient. So I think the idea, I don't know what inaccuracies anyone's talking about. And if Corbin would like to elaborate, I'd be happy to respond. But I think that the lower courts were actually really understood the facts well. And I would say, I don't think the Supreme Court read the record. It was clear to me that the dissent had a much better grasp of the facts. I guess, did I respond to your question?
Yeah, you did. And I'll turn to Corbin. Don't want to put you on the spot.
The last thing I want to do.
I also want you to, maybe I'm being hyperbolic. I want you to walk me off the ledge that this traceability standard, as I read it, it seems to say you've got to show, you've got to show the email where the government official said, take Brent Scorp's post down. And it seems like short of that is pretty difficult. But yeah, feel free to respond to anything that's been said.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing I want to do is take up our whole hour with Janine and me arguing the record. So, you know, the 22 million tweets versus 4,000 is a problem. The fabricated quotes of Rene DiResta, of targeting domestic speakers, of the threat of, quote, legal consequences, what the press secretary never said. You have problems with talking about CISA and how the election integrity partnership was actually set up. You have problems with the word targeting being used. I would recommend people take a look at Stanford's amicus brief in the case where they get into this. And I'm sure Janine probably has disagreements with what that brief says, but I think that brief and certainly footnote 4 speak for themselves. I don't think Justice Barrett would make that line lightly. Now, hopefully to say some things that Janine will agree with. I think what we ultimately need to land on is something between the broadest possible reading of the majority opinion and the dissent. Because at times the majority does, I mean, they never say this explicitly, but they make it sound like you need to be like named directly. And that just can't. That can't be the standard. I mean, that's highly problematic. They noted that the platforms had, you know, independent incentives to moderate content. And I have thoughts on that, but like, I know this much, that cannot possibly be like a get out of jail free card. It can't be like, well, somewhere in the mix, we have an incentive. And so, you know, plaintiffs lose, that can't be right. Josh, you know, I think it's an interesting question whether the majority, agrees that there was no violation. I mean, I don't think they ever say that explicitly. That's certainly not my read of the justices from the oral argument, but you're right. Like they don't come in on that. I think ultimately we have to kind of hope that like this opinion is not read broadly. Their decision was shaped in part, I think, by how it was litigated and adjudicated below. Vulo being a few months before, maybe we should take heart that like, you know, these things are not, a lot is left to be fought over. And then the last thing I just want to insert, because I don't want to derail us, but I thought Josh's discussion was interesting. And I'm wondering if he has thoughts on whether maybe some of the conservative justices in the majority were like spooked by Massachusetts versus EPA, seeing like a decision that maybe all of us in the room would be see as like a stretch of what states can bring in and sue on, and if that maybe derailed them. And the reason I bring that up in this answer is I think there just were a lot of hydraulic pressures on this case that might have shaped the majority opinion in ways that maybe they'll actually change course a bit in future decisions.
Well, so I've been thinking about this a lot, and you know, there was a lot of coverage in the past 4 years since Justice Barrett was nominated of like, oh, this is the conservative court that's going to like roll back everybody's rights, blah, blah, blah. And like, that's what you're getting from, you know, the cottage industry niche press that appears to just criticize the Supreme Court 24 hours a day, right? Like that's the kind of coverage you're getting. And in fact, what you get instead is, you know, a group of justices who have for, you know, their entire legal upbringing been very, very, very skeptical of standing. And so, I mean, that's what you've seen this year and last year and the year before is just really just ratcheting up the standing requirements in case after case after case. So Mass v. EPA, you know, pretty much most conservatives disagreed with that opinion, thought it was, you know, far beyond the outer reaches of standing. And so, you know, it almost looks like they're kind of trying to self overrule some of these opinions. Like I said, in the parents patriae context, like the Supreme Court is just absolutely wrong to cite that decision in SNAP without recognizing that there are several different decisions after SNAP that completely undermine that opinion with respect to parents patriae. Supreme Court's just entirely wrong, and they're ignoring that line of precedent there. But you look at that and then, you know, same thing with Department of Commerce. I think Justice Alito is right. I don't know how you can you know, the Department of Commerce was unanimous with respect to the standing question. New York could sue because there was a predictable effect that the census question on the, or the citizenship question on the census was going to lead to reduced, you know, a reduced number of individuals filling out the census. Well, of course, it's a predictable effect that when you have this kind of government pressure, there is going to be censorship. And so I think it's a similar situation where the Supreme Court is kind of trying to cabin these other standing doctrines without saying so explicitly.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers. Founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental power is essential to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.